Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we zero in a little bit on fall fruits and fall gardening with our guest from UW Extension, Scott Royce, back with us coming from our Green Bay studios, as a matter of fact. He's a UW Extension crops, soils, and horticulture agent for Marinette and Oconto counties. Always fun to have Scott come by. And we'll talk about what's going on in your garden a little bit. Do you have questions about harvesting or storing produce? What about fruits? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Scott Royce, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Great to have you, Scott. Let's talk of fruit for just a minute here. What was the harvest like this year in Wisconsin? Any ideas on that?
Well, it's still ongoing. That's part of the problem. Patience was probably the key word in fruit harvest this year because it was behind schedule. And I was actually out at the Peninsula Ag Research Station this week on doing some other stuff. And they are still in the middle of harvesting in reality. They've got a lot of cultivars of apples that are still on trees. They've even got some, well, not even, I should say, it's not too unusual, but some of their grape cultivars are still on vine, although I think they were in the process of getting the last of, or most of the last of those too. So yeah, patience and dealing with diseases. Those are the two key phrases to fruit management in 2019.
Jan in Viroqua has a question relating to fruit, so let's go to her. Hi, Jan.
Good morning. I have a beautiful crop of Liberty apples on my baby tree, and I'm wondering, do they keep better on the tree as long as the weather doesn't freeze, or should I have picked them already, or should I pick them now and have the best store them? I'd love to make an apple pie for Thanksgiving out of them.
Yeah.
Okay. In general, it's probably safer to go ahead and get them harvested now. Liberty are kind of a mid-season apple, so they should definitely be mature or even beyond mature. If they held on through the windstorms or wind events that we've had in the last couple of weeks, I give them kudos for that. We've had a lot of windfalls this year, and that's a huge problem, of course. No, I would go ahead and definitely plan on getting them harvested sooner rather than later, because especially at this time of the year, you never know what can happen, either with, as we already mentioned, wind events, migrating bird, you know, flocks of robins come through, and suddenly you go from having a nice-looking tree full of harvestable apples to, you know, cores hanging on the tree. Go ahead and get them into storage. Within reason, cold and humid is what you want for most of our fall fruits. Liberty is kind of one of our standard storage apples, so they want to be at, again, high humidity and temperatures in those mid-30s in a perfect world, mid to upper 30s. There are a few cultivars of apples that like it either a little bit warmer or a little bit colder, but for the most part, if you think of a normal cold fridge, that's about the right temperature, but the humidity is key. So if you have an old fridge that you can maybe disconnect the defroster unit, that's one way to do it, because then you have more consistent humidity. Otherwise, keep an open pan of water in the fridge, maybe, if you have one that's really oriented more toward just apple or other fruit storage.
And is Jan going to be able to make that apple pie for Thanksgiving? Are they going to hold till then?
I would think so. Liberty is I would kind of consider them a moderate storage one. They're not an extremely long storage apple, but they're pretty good. So I would think they would hang on until then, you know, because we're only, 6 weeks away, to 6 weeks away. So I would think that they would still be all right from that. But worst case scenario, if you don't think they're going to, I would go ahead and get them ready for pie and freeze them, you know, just treat them with lemon juice as you're getting them ready.
Sure.
And freeze them that way. And then you'll still maintain all of the flavor and nutrient quality that way.
And Jan, if you have any extra apple pies along about that time, you could ship one or two to Wisconsin Public Radio.
enough.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. As long as we're on apples, I had a great email from a listener who shared a photo of their apple tree. It's a yellow transparent, and this tree has been bearing for over 65 years, and sent a picture, and it does look like it's 65 years old for sure. It yep. bears regularly every year. Its interior, as I can see on the photo, has been hollowed out. The tree was cabled together at a height of about 4 feet to prevent it from falling over, but it still bears the very best fruit, even though the amount varies by year. That's pretty yeah. cool.
Yeah, and that's one of the neat things about apple and pear trees in particular is their longevity. As long as we give them a little bit of care and particularly put them in the right spot to begin with. I've got pear trees in the oldest one I know of that's verifiable is actually right on the border of Okano and Marinette County, and that farm they know who planted that tree and approximately when, so we know that pear tree is at least 107 years old.
Wow.
So, and I can pretty much guarantee there are apple trees older than that in the state and probably even pear trees as well.
Ah, that is so cool. Well, what's prevented apple trees and other trees, fruit trees, from making that 100 years this year? Were there some things that really raised heck with the trees?
Yeah, well, certainly depending on where you were in the state, up in far northeast Wisconsin here, we had a wind event or two that really created havoc on trees, forests in particular, of course, but also managed trees. So wind is one of those things that can obviously create havoc on our fruit trees because of their bearing weight. Anytime you have a tree that is in fruit season, you have a lot more weight than that tree is in some cases, unfortunately, even really meant to hold, because people in our wisdom, sometimes we let nature take its course, and nature and our long-term plans don't always go together. So the tree actually can put too many fruit on and then have that excess load, and that creates branch breaking conditions very readily, even in good conditions. And then we top that off with some pretty heavy wind, and we can get lots of broken branches, snapped off trees. With the extreme wetness that we've had over the consistent growing season this year, we've also got a lot of root structures the root structures technically are still fine, but the soil is so saturated, we've seen trees just literally tip over because the structure and holding capacity just isn't there.
David in Minnesota has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, David.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is a winter hydroponic garden I'd like to start inside. I don't have a nice south-facing window, so my concern was the effectiveness of using grow lights, LED grow lights. Got any comments on that?
Well, they're certainly very good for those purposes, and the improvements that have come through in lighting technology are really kind of amazing in the combination of increased efficiency but yet still getting all of the wavelengths that we need for good proper plant growth. So a little bit dependent on what you're going to plan – or what you are planning on growing, that can dictate somewhat to what your lumen intensity is going to be and how much you may not want to invest in lighting. But certainly their technology is great and fairly easy to utilize now and has come down a lot in price in the last 10 years as well.
And where would you go? Is there a place where you can go to say, okay, how many lumens do I need for this vegetable or that?
Yeah, there are I can't think of the best ones off the top of my head as far as websites, but I know that there are some very good websites available both through universities and then also through some of the actual suppliers themselves of lights. The hydroponic and aquaponic industry has really taken off in the last 10 to 15 years. So there is information that has been collected both on the research side, so the kind of the .edu type websites, as well as on the .com. That are selling stuff. And the way to use those types of sites is kind of just compare and contrast a little bit and make sure that you're getting good quality information that agrees with each other if you start on a .com website.
I use them for limey, my lime tree, in the wintertime. Fortunately, I have also a south-facing window, but those lights, I have them in a pole lamp, so they're at different mm-hmm. levels. And if you grab a hold of the cone of the pole lamp, you're not going to burn your hand.
Yep. Yeah.
They're not wasting electricity, for sure.
Yep. Yeah, that's where some of the major efficiency increases have come in new plant lighting, is that they've decreased the heat release. Now, some people kind of banked on that heat from their lights, and they didn't need to plan on other heating sources, so that may have changed what they needed to do for heat supplementation in their plants. That's maybe the downside of it, but from the electrical efficiency standpoint, yeah, they are amazing compared to where they used to be.
Yeah, absolutely. David, I hope that helps.
Yeah, it did. I was going to comment. I found a good selection at Menards for the LED grill lights, and so that's what I'm going to be using.
Yeah.
And I understand the issue about the heat, because that soil temperature is really important, especially for tomatoes, which was my number one desire when I started this.
And again, pay attention to how close those lights have to be to the plants themselves. Isn't that right, Scott?
Yes. Yeah. Light. Whenever we're supplementing natural sunlight with any type of artificial, whether it's LED or whether it's the old style combination of incandescent and fluorescent, or however it is that you're going to be doing that, you've got to pay attention to both lumen quality and quantity. So yes, spacing is usually a lot closer than what we think it should be for our plants to get maximum light efficiency.
Yeah, I've got on Limey, I've got, I think, 6 inches maybe from the plant.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go, David. Make sure you check on heights as well when you're setting all this up. Thanks for calling. We had Jeremy and Racine next. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. In reference with the LED grow lighting, I use them. I didn't buy mine from Menards. I went on Amazon and I got one. And I had it on an offshoot in my house next to my living room, because I didn't have very good lighting in my living room area. And it was great at first, a lot of good growth and everything, but my wife started complaining. She'd get headaches from the radiant light coming off of these LEDs. So I had to adjust it back to a regular CFL bulb kind of thing. I guess I might have had a little bit of an overkill, so to speak, but I was hoping to get, be successful with it. But again, with the LEDs, they can be pretty powerful.
All right. Thanks, Jeremy. That's one I haven't heard about, someone getting headaches from them.
Well, light associated with headaches is not that uncommon. I haven't seen specific studies in relation to the wavelengths that are more specific to LEDs, but I do know in my own family that there are a couple of us that are susceptible to light-induced migraines. So I can understand the comment very well, trust me.
Okay.
I can't directly relate it to the LED wavelengths.
Jonathan in Shorewood, your turn. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, guys. I have a grapevine in my yard. It's got really good light, not so great soil, I don't think, but it was doing well for the first 5 years I had it in there. And these last two seasons, it's gotten probably a fungal disease that I haven't treated. I haven't been around to treat it when it really took hold. And much of the plant, the leaves, of course, have fallen off and decaying. And I'm wondering if should I cut some of the stems too, the vines themselves have pitted black disease or fungus on them. Should I cut all of that off and try to start from scratch with the old wood, or is this guy a goner?
Okay. I wouldn't go with the last point of it being a goner.
No.
These last 2 years have been extremely impressive in their fungal capacity. It's been a great couple of years to be mushrooms and not so great to be plants trying to grow without having disease pressure. So especially on grapes. Just this year alone, I saw grapevines that even though very well placed, full airflow, full sun, they were still inundated with either powdery mildew or downy mildew or black rot in particular, or some of the other diseases that grapes can get. So I would be a little bit optimistic about the future yet, although if you are seeing signs on the vines themselves that is probably a sign, so to speak, to maybe do some extra pruning. Maybe not going all the way down to the old wood and making them restart completely, but really kind of being thorough in your analysis of the health of the vines that you are keeping. And do remember, and it sounds like you have been doing a fair pruning job anyway, but grapes are one of those plants that need to be pruned harder than most of us are willing to accept. They do better when we prune them well rather than letting them go too much, because they literally get too much growth for their own good, and then the fruit quality and yield suffer.
Yeah, and I like that little publication on growing grapes in Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
that little extension, because they do a nice job in there of talking about pruning grapes.
Yes, yeah, there are extension publications available that can help you walk through the process. There are also education YouTube channels that have pretty good, relatively short, easy to watch videos that give you some pointers too, that give you a little bit closer up views of exactly how to make certain types of cuts, as well as certain things to look for on the diseases that can overwinter right on the canes. So seeing that stuff in person makes it a lot easier to be able to really follow it through.
Now, for Jonathan, is this one of those times because of the disease issue where you would be dipping your pruning shears or whatever before you make the next cut each time?
It's always a good idea when you know that you're dealing with diseased material, certainly, to either use one of the spray alcohol type products, like the Lysols of the world or whatever, or a bleach solution, whichever one you're willing to use. The bleach solutions are cheaper. They're just harder on the equipment, so you have to keep stuff better. Cleanliness has to be a little bit better. At an absolute bare minimum, you should definitely be sterilizing equipment in between plants. But if you are definitely working with disease material, so the types of stuff we were just talking about with the grapes or fire blight on apples or pears, that's the worst one.
Yeah.
Then we definitely want to be sterilizing in between cuts.
Scott Royce, our guest today, UW Extension Crop Soils Horticulture Agent for Marinette and Oconto Counties. Jane Rotunda, our producer today. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Royce, UW Extension Crop Soils Horticulture Agent for Marinette and Oconto Counties. Talking with him, well, we've talked fruit a little bit. We've gotten into some other areas as well. Certainly, if you have a question about your garden or your trees or your fruit trees, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, Carol emailed and wondered, why is it advised to store onions and squash in the pantry versus the refrigerator? They keep better in the fridge.
That's because of the temperature relations with their cellular processes. Tomatoes and eggplant are actually in the same ballpark. Peppers, they want to be warmer than the fridge temperatures or root cellar temperatures. The same thing would apply with trying to store stuff like that in a root cellar. Now, some of the onions can handle being in a root cellar for a fair amount of time, but they don't do as well long term. But squashes, tomatoes, peppers, that kind of thing in particular, they really do not do well if the temperature is low like that, you know, down in those fridge temperature ranges. I can give you some concrete numbers with peppers, tomatoes, eggplant tissue. That tissue actually starts deteriorating at 50 degrees. So obviously, you know, October is not great growing conditions for that either. But also from a storability standpoint, we want to get those things harvested before we start getting the consistent cold weather, and then try to store it in an area where we're at that 50 to 55 degree range if possible. And then obviously if we start, you know, cutting on a big tomato and we don't finish it in one sandwich, then it has to go in the fridge to prevent bacterial or fungal contamination. That's a different story. But for whole fruit storage, the whole cucurbit family, i.e. the squashes and pumpkins and such, they really want to be in that 45 to 50 degree range if possible.
Let's take a call from Pat in East Troy next. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a weird tree that started out to be Paula Plum and was grafted onto something else, which I think may be producing Honeycrisp apples, and they're delicious, except I haven't gotten rid of the bugs, and they're all penetrated. But I need to know how to get rid of the Paula Plum without damaging the parent tree that I would like to keep.
Hmm.
And it's branches here, there, and everywhere.
Okay.
Do you see them? I mean, can you see the trunks at the base at all, or are they sort of right together?
Yeah. The branches grow within 3 feet of the base, and the parent tree is about 20 feet tall, and the Paula Plum shoots up branches and is pretty for about a week when it blooms in spring, but otherwise it's a useless thing to have.
Okay. So, okay. Scott, what do you think?
Well, it certainly sounds like a situation where there are actually two trees growing essentially together.
Yeah.
And that certainly can happen because stone fruits and the apple fruits are not able to be grafted onto the same rootstock. So there has to be at least two sets of rootstock down there somewhere. Now, they could literally be almost to the point of looking fused. That can happen, but they are separate trees. So if you do desire to get rid of the one, as you call it, the Paul Plum, you should be able to take care of that without hurting the remaining apple tree. You just have to be very careful in how you're making those cuts and trying to minimize any damage to the remaining material that you want to leave. It could take a little bit of work because it's not a situation where I would be able to recommend utilizing any chemical assistance in your processes. So just try cutting it out and then seeing how it responds and going from there. You may have to continually prune material off for a year or maybe even two until it completely dies off.
Yeah, but cut her down as low as you can at the base.
Yep, yeah, and just really kind of look and see, you know, they could be twisted together, you know, they could be essentially almost even joined together and looking like they're coming up as one trunk, even though if you look closely enough, you can actually see that there's a suture essentially in the center or off to the side, you know, depending on how they're growing. But there should be something that's visible that you can use as a cue on where to make your cuts.
Might want to take, because it sounded like the branches were kind of growing together too, it sounds like something where I might want to start with some of the branches that might create damage if you cut at the base.
Always work from your, in a case like this, always work from your way up and then work down. When you're doing typical fruit tree pruning, we kind of want to start in the center and work out so that we don't make mistakes. In this case, yeah, we want to try to minimize any damage that we would do. So work with the smaller material first and get it out of the way so that it doesn't cause any extra ripping or tearing damage.
Yeah, there you go, Pat. Thanks much for calling. Good luck with that tree. James in Fall Creek, it's your turn.
Thank you very much. I have some grapes growing on arbors, and nothing has been done to them for perhaps 20 years. I would like to prune them and start them again, so I would like to know the severity of pruning that I would take and the time of year that I should do that.
Okay. You've got a couple of different options, realistically speaking. There is always the option, and I'm not recommending this, I'm just saying it's an option, but you always have the option basically of cutting them down, not quite to the ground level, but fairly, you know, within a foot or two of the ground level, that back to old wood, and then letting them start over from there. So that can work best in a situation where they really are not matching the trellis or the arbor, the situation anymore. It may be better in the long run to just go that route. Otherwise, if they've got fairly good structure and you just really need to thin them down and get them back under control, then the best timing for that is usually what we consider our normal fruit pruning season, which would be anywhere from, you know, later March into with grapes, depending on, you said Park Falls, so you can probably go in as late as early May in some years, but usually, you know, mid-March to mid-April is kind of opportune time, because then we can see if there has been any severe winter damage, and we can, you know, work around that or get rid of that first before we start making decisions. Go ahead and get that grapevine back into the shape that you want it to be, and remembering that grapes mostly produce fruit. Most cultivars of grapes produce fruit on buds 2 through 5 of what would be this year's growth for next year's fruit. So whatever they put on in 2019, that's going to be the fruit-producing wood next year. So if you do want to still try to have fruit next year, that's something to keep in mind. Otherwise, you know, really focus on reshaping it, getting it back into the shape that you want it to do at the potential expense of fruit production in 2020.
And James, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jason in Wausau will give you a chance. Hi, Jason.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I had three. One of them died. Apple trees in my yard, and I bought the house 6 years ago. I don't think they were really in that great of shape. There was no pruning. They seemed to be overgrown, where there's a lot of vertical growth off of the main trunks that kind of came out to the side. My question, to try to be concise, is what should I be doing? Because when these do bear fruit, the fruit quality is very low. And it never really tastes good, but really all the pruning I've done is to kind of try to get rid of some of the larger, cumbersome branches that make it really difficult to work around the tree. I haven't done a lot of precise pruning on it or anything like that. And I guess I just haven't paid too much attention to the trees other than just to be able to mow around them and whatnot. So my question is, what can I do to make those, you know, bear better quality fruit? And is there something that I should be doing that I'm probably not?
Okay. Could be a little bit of a tricky question because even if they are smaller fruit and of lower quality, the flavor should hopefully be somewhat similar, even if you are getting undersized fruit. So that is one question that homeowners do have to ask themselves at some point in time is, do I actually really like this apple, or am I better pulling it out and starting over with something else that our family really likes to eat? Now, I'm not saying that's the case here, but it is something – to consider down the road. But in general, with a tree like that that has not had a lot of work with it, we really have to focus on opening up the canopy so that we get better light and air penetration within that canopy, because that's going to lead to less pest pressure and higher quality fruit. And it will also hopefully meter out the fruit load so that we get good size to our fruit structure as well. Most apple cultivars really should not have more than one apple fruit every 8 to 10 inches of branch. And when you look on the stereotypical homeowner tree, it's more like 7.
Yeah.
We tend to overload our trees, or let them be overloaded, I guess is probably the better way to say it. So doing some branch thinning, and then maybe considering doing some fruit thinning when the fruits are the size of your fingernails or thumbnails, you know, that 2 to 3 week after petal fall time frame, if the flowers are really abundant and it looks like you got good fruit set, you know, maybe doing a little bit of fruit thinning as well is another way to improve the quality of the fruit, and particularly improve the size of the fruit.
All right. Jason, does that help?
Very much so. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good luck.
You can join in too, by the way. I've got some open lines, get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Robert in Sandbarn, it's your turn. Hi, Robert.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, very good. I have an eastern white pine. It's kind of older, but I'm just talking about two lower limbs. I want to kind of put a camper back there. And is it okay to trim the limbs right now? And do you have to put any kind of a sealant on the limbs to trim them?
Okay. And this was a white pine?
Eastern white pine.
Eastern. Okay. I was just making sure I heard it correctly. Let's answer the second part first. The second part is, do you want to use a sealant? No. Sealants are hardly ever an advisable thing when doing any kind of pruning on trees or perennials, period. And the only cases are is if we have imminent disease danger. So if you have to repair storm damage on oaks or elms or something like that, that can get one of our deadly diseases like oak wilt or Dutch elm disease. So the sealant thing, no, we don't want to do that. As far as timing, it's not optimum timing to do conifer pruning to go up like that. I wouldn't be afraid to do one rung or two at a time, but then it's not exactly optimum timing to do that. So I'd prefer to wait until either in spring or else actually midsummer can work for that too, depending on on how much you need to do. And that's always a little bit dangerous on answering questions like this over the phone.
Sounds like Robert wants to get his camper back there, though, or his trailer.
Yeah. And the size of the tree makes a big difference, too.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead, Robert.
Okay. The tree's at least 80 feet tall. I just want to do one lower branch. That's all I want to do. And is it going to kill the tree, you think? And if I do it, how far in do you do it?
Right to the base.
Okay. Yeah. And anytime you're making a pruning cut, make sure you do take the entire branch off, but without going into the trunk itself. So in the case here where you've got one really large branch, it is trickier. You've got to make sure you're following good, safe procedures as well. So you're doing, you know, a multi-cut method and not trying to just take a chainsaw up there and ping one cut with that, because more often than not, what's going to happen there is you're going to get bark tearing down further on the trunk, and then you are going to create a wound that's going to create a problem for the future of the tree. But if you're only taking one branch off, then yes, then I wouldn't be as concerned, I guess, about getting that done now. But if a normal conifer situation and you're going to take a couple of rings of branches off to get that clearance or something like that, that you want to kind of do that in stages, and this is not optimum timing for that kind of a practice.
There you go, Robert. Thanks a lot for calling. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Richard in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about raspberries. I've got a patch maybe 20 by 30 feet, and I thin them out every spring, you know, get rid of the dead stuff and stuff. But this year, I just didn't get a lot.
Yeah. You're kind of breaking up a little bit. So Richard had raspberry crop. He's done a good job of taking care of them over the years. This year didn't get a very good crop.
Okay. Well, first off, remember that there are two distinctly different types of raspberries, those that only bloom in summer, or what we call summer-bearing raspberries, and those are those canes fruit on any of the canes that overwinter from last year's growth. And then the second type is fall-bearing, which can do both styles of fruit production. So they'll have a summer crop from ones that overwintered from the previous year. And then if we have enough and good enough quality growth, they will produce a fall crop or a late summer crop on the earliest of the canes that emerge in a particular growing season. So that dictates management of raspberry patches quite a bit. It sounds like this is probably more of a summer-bearing raspberry, which is our more traditional ones too. There, what can happen anytime we have overwintering challenges, we can certainly cut back on our fruit set. And I know a lot of places in northern Wisconsin, at least last year, we did have pretty tough overwintering conditions on our raspberries. Now, where cane survival was not as good, or partial canes would survive, but the entire canes wouldn't. So I do know a lot of areas where we really did suffer on those summer-bearing raspberry crops this year because of the winter, primarily the ice and ups and downs in temperatures that we had in the 2018-2019 winter.
Yeah, when I saw where Richard was from, I thought, oh, I've heard this story before on Garden Talk. We've had a lot of people ask about what the heck happened to my raspberries this year, and many of them were from the northern part of Wisconsin for sure.
Yeah, the combination of conditions just was not very good in that winter.
Thanks, Richard. Appreciate it. Paul in Tomahawk, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, gentlemen. My question is, there's quite a few people have pear trees right here. I'm about in the middle, a little about the middle state, a little higher than that. But nobody knows the name of the pear trees that they have. So I'm trying to find out, which is not an unusual question usually when I ask somebody. But I'm just trying to find out if you know, because I want to plant some pear trees, because the ones they have do quite well. So I'll just kind of, maybe if you gentlemen would know, what kind I should plant.
Well, that's a tricky question and a dangerous question as well, because my standard reply to getting questions about selecting fruit cultivars is try to find ones that you can taste test first so that you know you are going to like them. So that's always a starting point. And then in a situation like this, what I quite honestly tend to recommend is you're a lot better served, especially if you don't know what kinds they are, to get pear rootstock and do some of your own grafting, or find someone in the area that does custom grafting and start your own trees from those old trees rather than trying to reinvent the wheel, because that's the easiest way to make sure that you're going to get that same kind of fruit if that's the one that you really like. Another opportunity for you to consider, especially with where you're located, is consider contacting one of our state fruit specialists. Particularly, I'm thinking of Brian Smith over in UW River Falls, and seeing if he has some specific suggestions for your locale there, because you're a lot closer to where he does his research than where I would have better knowledge of cultivars that do well on the eastern side of the state.
So if you type in Brian Smith, UW Stevens Point.
River Falls.
I'm sorry, UW River Falls.
Yep.
You're going to get his picture and phone information and all that pops up.
He is one of our longtime fruit researchers. He's actually one of the ones who was integral. He was primarily responsible for the development of the black ice plum, amongst a few other fruit cultivars. So a wealth of knowledge. But like I say, I do mean what I said to begin with, is that when you have, especially pears, when you have those older style trees that do well in a locale, keep grafting them, because they're going to probably continue to do well then, because there's a lot of variation within the genetics of our fruit trees, and apple and pear in particular. So finding those ones that do well and meet your storage and flavor desires, really it goes a long way to be able to work with them.
Yeah. So do you think Paul's going to be able to find somebody who knows about grafting up there?
There certainly should be. I know that there are a few nurseries in that general neck of the woods too, so I can't imagine that he's not going to be able to find a few. Otherwise, Brian may know of others that would do it around that area too, or he can look me up on email and I can get him in touch with others as well.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate the question and the comment. Scott Royce, our guest today, UW Extension Crops, Soils, Horticulture Agent for Marinette and Oconto Counties. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in as we visit with Scott Royce, UW Extension Horticulture Agent for Marinette and Oconto Counties. He also works in crops and soils as well. Join in with a question. We've got open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Jim in Sauk City up next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I have a question about arborvitae seeds, starting them. And also, are box elder trees any good? And when's the best time to prune oak trees?
Okay.
All right. I think I've got all those down for you.
Yeah. I'll start with the easy one first. Pruning of oak trees whenever the soil is frozen is the easiest recommendation, because then we don't have to worry at all about disease transfer, particularly oak wilt. The official state recommendations expand that a little bit, but this year with all the moisture we had, that's what I was telling everybody, is wait until frozen soil season, because the moisture has just been too intense this year to even take a risk. Normally we can get away with it a little bit later in summer or something, but I wouldn't have done it this year. Try to do any oak or elm pruning during frozen soil season, because then you really basically eliminate, I probably shouldn't say it that way, but essentially eliminate the opportunity for those really dastardly diseases to get transferred into your trees.
Box elders, are they any good?
It depends on if you like burning, quick burning firewood or not. Everything has a place, okay? At our place where we live, we use box elder as erosion control on a slope, and we use them for in our fireplace, and they certainly have their purpose. If you like seeing box elder bugs at this time of the year, then you definitely want to have some box elder trees around. I mean, they're a neat little insect, but they're a royal pain for a lot of people. They are native maple, so it's not like they are a bad thing, but most people do consider them to be pretty weedy trees because of their seed potential. So they spread readily and come up all over the place. They are a fast-growing tree, thus they are a fast-burning wood as well. So they're not high-quality firewood either, but they're at least decent. That's one of those personal opinion questions as much as anything.
Yeah.
So. But they certainly do have native insect opportunities. There are a number of different native insects that will feed on them. A lot of birds will utilize them for nesting habitat because of their structures. So they do certainly have good points.
The other question he had was about starting some seeds, and I'm not remembering now. Did you have a
arborvitae seed?
Arborvitae
is what he mentioned, and I will bluntly admit that I don't know the precise best germination conditions for them. I do work with a lot of seed in my job and in my past and as a grad student for that matter, but arborvitae is not one I've done much with, so I would have to do some research on that, or you can get in contact with your local extension office if you want more specific information. Certainly as a native tree, there should certainly be possibilities there. It's just a matter of if there are specific storage or seeding conditions that we need for them.
Yeah, do they need a cold spell and all of that?
I would assume they do, because most of our native trees do.
Yeah. So there you go, Jim. Thank you so much. Jim in Marshfield, you're next. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
I have a Honeycrisp apple tree that is very, very good. It gives a lot of apples, but every year they have these black spots on like a fungus. Green, black discoloration.
Okay, just on the exterior of the skin?
Just the exterior of the pectin, yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's...
And
that's
the apple itself on the inside is delicious. It's better tasting than most that you buy up in Bayfield.
All right.
I won't tell Jason Fishbach that. But, no, that is probably one of our two... exterior skin fungal diseases known as sooty blotch and fly speck. And if it is a kind of a circular lesion with distinct black spots within the lesion, that is fly speck. And then the other one is sooty blotch, where it looks a little bit more like it got dusted with something than anything else.
And you can get both of them at the same time too.
Oh yeah, they tend to occur together, especially in a year like this where we have this constant humidity that we've had. So it's very common in years like this. But some cultivars are more susceptible to them than others. So there are distinct cultivar differences, and it partially goes because of the skin itself that is on a particular cultivar. Skin that is thicker and a little bit more rich. Rigid tends to be a little bit less susceptible to that than some of the other cultivars. They are diseases that can be managed with fungicides if you want to, but as you mentioned already in your call, they don't really affect the interior fruit quality much at all. The only thing that they can do, especially if it's a bad year for them, is that they can cut down on the storability of the fruit. It's not like they're going to cut the storage time in half, but they will probably cut it down by a noticeable difference in, you know, either days, weeks, or months, depending on the cultivar. So that's really the only downside of it. Otherwise, yeah, you can just peel that portion of it off, and the rest of the peeling should actually still be perfectly fine and edible too. But like I say, the storability does decrease, and there is a theoretical chance of a little bit increase of other diseases getting in through those spots, but it doesn't happen nearly as often as with most of our other diseases.
Did you ever use one of those apple peelers?
Those yes, cranky? I have used them in my past.
I just wondered. I don't have one, and I wondered if anybody ever used them and if they had any luck with them.
Oh, yeah. They can work fairly well. I actually use those things as props in some of my discussions about fruit management, because I ask people very bluntly, okay, so I ask, you know, how many of you have one of those apple paracord slicer thingamabobbers? And, you know, usually about half of the group raises their hand. And then I ask, well, do they have different inserts for different size apples as far as that core prong thing? And they say, no. Well, there's a point here. That's because apples have the same number of seeds, whether they're a small crab apple or a gargantuan Wolf River. So the more fruit that you have on a tree, generally the smaller the fruit size will be. And to get better quality apples that have a higher percentage of edibility, we want to have fewer fruit per tree. So those apple paracord slicers are actually a kind of a prop in helping people understand a little bit about fruit tree management.
Aren't you the smart guy? That's a great way to do it.
It's just an easy way to help people really see that, you know.
Oh, boy. Well, there you go, Jim. Pam in Lanesboro, Minnesota. Hello.
Hi, I'm calling about raspberry plants and when is the best time to transplant them. I have plants that produce fruit in the summer and in the fall, and they've actually still been producing up until last week. So we wanted to move them, but didn't want to cut them down when they were still
producing.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, the blunt answer with raspberries is just about any day you can dig in the soil, they'll probably survive. They are very hardy.
Yeah.
and literally probably our most our most amenable fruit plant to getting moved around and transplanted. But in regard to your specific question there, what I would be looking at in for transplanting is transplanting the ones that I have not been fruiting this late fall, and find smaller plants that have not fruited, because they're going to have full energy. They're going to be able to, if you want them to, they're going to be able to fruit next summer yet. Otherwise, just wait until they come up next spring and move young canes right away in the spring. But because they are pretty adaptable, I mean, we're certainly getting to the late end now, but if you wait until those raspberries have gone dormant and just mark which ones you want to move and move them that way, otherwise you're probably better served to wait until next spring and move them as soon as you're essentially able to work in the soil, depending on your particular locale there. But raspberries are, if you keep them watered at all, they're pretty amenable to getting moved around. So you've got a lot more flexibility than probably any of the other stuff we would be talking about today.
Yeah. Where's Lanesboro, by the way? I was trying to think, Pam.
It's southeast Minnesota.
Okay, southeast Minnesota. Okay. Yeah, you shouldn't have any, you shouldn't really have any trouble getting them to live. That's for sure.
Yeah, as long as you don't move, you know, full size canes in the middle of summer. That's the one time where they can go downhill then. But other than that, yeah, you've got a little bit more flexibility.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Do you prune redbud trees? Joe's got one that looks like a bush.
Well, usually in the upper Midwest, we don't have to prune redbud trees because they're not quite hardy enough and they die back on their own, at least further north where I am at. If you need to, you certainly can, but that is a species that is very marginal, so it's not something that you need to do a lot with.
Scott Royce, our guest today. Scott, a UW Extension Crop Soils Horticulture Agent for Marinette and Oconto counties. Always happy to have him with us for Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. You are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Royce, UW Extension Crop Soils and Horticulture Agent for Marinette and Oconto County. So, what gardening questions do you have for us today? Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Speaking of emails, Mark in Mount Prospect, Illinois, says he successfully germinated a number of Kentucky tree seeds. He now has a dozen saplings about 6 to 8 inches tall in pots, wonders how to overwinter them to keep them alive. He wants to get them more mature and established before putting them in a permanent place.
Okay. A Kentucky coffee tree is a little bit of an unusual tree. It has very, very large individual leaves, and because they have multiply compound pinnate leaves. So very unusual tree, and big pods that they produce, and the seeds are pretty substantial as well. But anyway, in regards to overwintering, if they're in pots like that, the best thing is to literally bury the pots at the soil level so that they are in a normal soil situation, and then consider after the soil cools off well, if not starts getting crunchy, go ahead and mulch a little bit over them with something that'll help maintain a more consistent temperature there.
Are the rabbits going to eat them up?
There's a little bit of a chance with that, you know, as with any young trees. So, you know, he may want to consider doing some type of extra protection there or putting them in a place where he doesn't have to worry about it, depending on what he's got available.
Let's take a call. Bruce in Skokie, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, when you were talking about grow lights, and especially the ones at Menards, first of all, when the man said that, you know, he bought LED grow lights at Menards, they don't have anything like that. They have shop lights that are LED. But I think more to the point is you mentioned lumens. And what I've found out recently, my research has found out that humans see lumens, plants don't. They don't respond to necessarily the lumens. What they respond to is something called P as in Paul, A as in Apple, R as in Robert, PAR. So there are PAR meters that you can get for lights, but they're pricey. They're about $300 that I found. And if you want to go the grow light that has the right amount of PAR light to it, which is, I think, the reds and the blues that most plants need, you're going to be spending a ton of money. Like one I saw was thousands and thousands, you know, $1,000 for a light. But I've been growing plants, geraniums, any kind of plant you can grow outside, and house plants under lights for decades. And I have no problem. The only thing is when I try and put a tropical hibiscus under a light, it'll survive, but it'll look pretty peaked at the end of the winter. But within 2 to 3 weeks after taking it outside and getting it in the full sunlight, it bounces right back.
So there you go. Well, what about PAR? Do you know about PAR?
It is, as he is, or as he's correctly said, you know, PAR is the kind of the plant side, and lumens. Lumens are a good substitute for it, though, as far as looking at some comparisons, just because of it does involve the intensity somewhat. But, yeah, if you really want to get in depth into it, if you're spending or putting money into a commercial type investment, certainly PAR is the type of data point that you're going to be looking at more so than just lumens or just, you know, types of bulbs or something like that.
Yeah.
Because you need to know what your return on investment is going to be.
And as plants see, you know, they get a little nasty in the winter, but then when he takes them right back out in the spring, they jump right back.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of plants that can be overwintered. A lot of us don't realize, you know, how much of a variation we can, even some of the things in our vegetable gardens, like a lot of our pepper plants can actually be overwintered because in their native habitat, they're perennials. We don't think about what we can do sometimes, and most of it goes to expense, space, and time. We just don't have any of the three.
Okay. Bruce, thanks again. Appreciate it very much. We have Zach in Ocano up next. Hi, Zach.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I got a hemp farm first year in Ocano growing up, and used dwarf white clover for a cover crop throughout the year just to kind of fight weed pressure. What I'm asking is, we're in the middle of harvest, bare land is coming up. Is there anything cover crop we could plant this year or spring next year for maybe a till-in around June 1st for planting June 15th?
Okay. At this late stage of the game, about the only thing that would do any good yet for planting this fall would be something like winter rye. Slight chance for winter wheat, but it's actually getting on the late side.
Rye's
for winter wheat. Yeah,
this time of year.
And for early planting next spring, if you are not able to get anything in right away and you want to get something in that you can work in that early June time frame, again, I would actually be looking at one of the spring grains there. Oats or barley are going to be your cheapest seeds and probably get the most growth right away so that you can get essentially a pretty good high-end green manure crop.
Thanks, Zach. Appreciate it. On to Greg in West Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate it, Greg. Thanks for calling.
A couple questions. One on butterfly bushes. I've got a couple of them that this year generated hundreds of monarch visitors, and I don't want to screw them up if I prune them improperly. And the second question is the pronunciation of clematis or clematis. And if that is to be pruned.
Okay. I've heard it
both ways all the time.
Yeah, you hear it. Most proper types say clematis a little bit more so, but it's personal preference as far as I'm concerned. Pruning of them, again, similar to grapes as far as timing, is probably wait until after winter just to make sure that we didn't have any winter damage. Because that can happen, especially on some cultivars. And then they certainly, because they are, they can be pretty overbearing in their growth, depending on the cultivar and the situation. You certainly may need to do some pruning back to keep them onto the support system that you have for them. But that's kind of a personal decision. It's, you know, from the biological standpoint, pruning may become necessary if they really do get overgrown because of having too much growth and not enough airflow, and they could even get to the point where they're not performing as well as you want just because of overgrowth. And now I'm blanking out on the first part
Butterfly
of your question.
Butterfly bush.
Okay. And by butterfly bush, I'm assuming you mean the non-native, which is commonly called butterfly weed, which that's actually a herbaceous perennial, but very good for an amazing plant for native insects. Butterfly bush, again, that's one that usually does not need to be pruned that much because they're not a real big shrub. So you shouldn't need to do much with them. But if you really do need to do some shaping back, that would be one I'd have to double check on timing. You shouldn't have an issue with that, but I just cannot distinctly remember whether they bloom on old wood or new wood.
All right. There we go. Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it. Lisa in Madison, your turn. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I have a Honeycrisp tree that produce. The yield is just too much every year. So I was wondering how to reduce that, and I was wondering, are they considered high maintenance? Because they look really bad.
Honeycrisp are probably on the upper end of maintenance for apple trees, just because they are a little bit pickier. They do tend to have a few more problems than some of our other cultivars, especially in the home orchard, because as home orchardists, most of us spend, maybe a week total managing our trees compared to a commercial orchard where they're managing them, 300 days out of the year. So definite difference in care level. But Honeycrisp, if it's got too many fruit on them, there's a couple of different approaches to that. One is to just simply prune harder and take more of the smaller branches and fruiting buds off ahead of season. Otherwise, after blooming after the flowers have successfully pollinated, go through in that 2 to 3 weeks after the petal, 10 to 20 days essentially actually is the better time frame. After the petals have fallen off of the flowers, you can really see if those small fruits have successfully pollinated, and then you can go ahead and thin out the fruits. Now, obviously, that works a lot better on smaller trees. If you've got bigger trees, and that's a lot harder to do hand pruning. On some bigger trees, you can actually cause some physical stress with something like a piece of PVC pipe or something, not a real big piece, obviously, but a little bit more flexibility to the piping, and knock some of those flowers off without hurting the branches. Otherwise, there are ways to do it with chemical applications as well, but at the homeowner level, that's pretty tricky,
and
probably not
it.
Recommended unless you have really done some research and have the right type of application equipment.
But for sure, you want to get that pruning in there and get that open those trees up.
Yeah, pruning and thinning and fruit thinning are the starting points. And then if it still doesn't get enough for you, then consider some of your other possibilities.
There you go, Lisa. Thank you. Lucy in Appleton, hello.
Well, good afternoon, Larry and Scott. I love your program.
Thank you
so much. Another apple question. Suggestions for cleanup after the apples are picked. We have a Macintosh. It's the standard, I'm sure. It's quite old. It had scab again, and it was worse last year with scab, but it had it again this year. And a lot of the, when the winds came, it knocked a lot of the fruit on the ground. But we were able to save some. But still, I'm wondering about the scab clean. We had some affected scab on our Cortland, a little on our Empire. The Empire came through the best. So what do you suggest for fall cleanup? I mean, just beyond basics, any other suggestions you have?
Okay, well, I'll take a moment here to review that because it is a very critical concept at this time of the year, especially in a year like this after we've had so much disease pressure. So absolutely, under any of our perennial fruits where we want to try to minimize disease transfer from one year to the next, cleanliness is the starting point. So get rid of all that material that may have disease inoculum on there, and that includes actually clipping off mummies that are on the tree. And that's very important for grapes and plums and any of the stone fruits because some of our worst diseases in those fruits really do exactly overwinter in those mummies, and that's how the inoculum is there for next year right away. So certainly with all of our perennial fruits, try to do that. Try to get the stuff off of the tree that's hanging on, and then rake up, do whatever makes sense for your situation as far as trying to get that material and inoculum off of the garden. It doesn't mean that you have to incinerate it or, you know, send it to a landfill or anything like that. Now, technically, you can because it is disease material or bury it, you know, if you have just a small amount. But you can also compost it and use it around other types of plants too. You know, you can basically make a compost pile of just your fruit stuff, but then put it around or put it into your vegetable garden or put it around some of your perennial flowers rather than putting that material back under your fruit trees. So that's certainly a key point. There are some other things to consider doing over the winter. And again, you know, we kind of railed on this a little bit already, but pruning is a huge part of good disease management. So doing good proper pruning in, you know, March and April to try to get more airflow through those trees. Now, I'm not insinuating that you haven't done a good job with it, but it's just one of the things we always have to think about with our fruit management. And then if you've had a lot of diseases that are continually overwintering on the tree and you know that that's one of the ways they can overwinter, you could consider something like a dormant oil or a lime sulfur dormant spray in that basically that same time of the year as when we're pruning or just a little bit later when it starts getting into the upper 40s and low 50s and trying to get rid of some of that inoculum that way too.
All right. There you go, Lucy. Thank you very much for calling. Jane in Fredonia. Hello to you.
Hi. I got a redbud tree that has a V crotch on the main trunk, and it's split like 6 inches or so. Is that tree pretty much done for?
Depends on the strength of those trunks that are left. And normally, again, a little bit dangerous doing this over the phone, i.e. radio, but normally what I say when you encounter a situation like that is that your best bet to try to save the tree is to really look at it, see which one is strongest, and take the other one off with a good proper pruning cut and see if the other one then is able to survive and continue to thrive from there. Otherwise, you know, that's the reason that V crotches should be removed earlier in the growth stages of life, and particularly true for fruit trees. It's absolutely critical that we try to eliminate V crotching on fruit trees if you are not an extremely high-level manager of your trees, because they end up becoming problems sooner rather than later.
There you go, Jane. Thank you so much. Dan in Westby, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, I was just wondering. I got some lily plants about a week ago. Wasn't expecting them and don't know where to put them. Is there a way I can keep them over the winter without putting them in the ground, or is it too late to put them in the ground anyway?
Definitely not too late to put them in the ground. Again, it kind of goes back to the coffee tree seedlings we were talking about before. If you're really not certain about where you want them to be, you're still better served to heel them in or put them in the pots that they're in and just bury them in the soil, because nothing that we are able to do as humans is as good as overwintering them in the soil that they're supposed to be in. So just going ahead and getting them buried properly and well so that there's very little airspace, if perfect world situation, no airspace around the roots or around those pots, and make that be a nice consistent situation for them over the winter, and that'll give them the best chance of surviving well, but then give you some time to think and plan as far as where you really want them to go.
There you go, Dan. Thanks so much. I was thinking about the UW-Madison campus. As I walk around the campus, I see a lot of the horticulture staff putting in bulbs.
Yep.
Lots of planning going on right now.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Nicole in Stevens Point, hi to you.
Good morning, or good afternoon. I have some zinnias outside, and they just look so pretty. I'm wondering, can I bring some of them in and plant them in a pot and try and keep them over winter?
You can certainly try. They are not going to do as well as they have been outside because unless you really provide high-quality light to them, they are certainly a plant that needs high-quality light to do well with both leaf quality as well as floral quality. But they may do at least fairly well for a month or so and give you some extra color in a otherwise kind of dreary time of the year maybe. So I definitely wouldn't advise against it, but the opportunity for them to do extremely well is probably a little bit less. I would focus on some of the smaller cultivars if you have any of those because they're going to probably transition a lot better than the really tall zinnias that most of us grow.
Nicole, thank you. Jan and Toma, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a brand new lasagna garden this year. It was the first planting, and I planted in tomatoes. I did get my tomatoes in late, and I went on vacation, and while I was gone, I got hit by this tomato blight, and all of my tomatoes, even the green ones, were splotchy with this tomato blight disease. What can I do to prevent that from happening next year? And also, we didn't have these kinds of diseases when I was growing up back in the 50s and 60s. We had gardens, huge gardens every year, and didn't have these kinds of issues. What's brought about all these diseases on plants? I don't understand what's brought all this on.
Okay. In reality, those diseases have been around for 4 decades, if not centuries. The presence of them, I'm not going to try to say that they haven't, that hasn't changed. It's partially maybe because of cultivar susceptibility has changed. It's partially because we pay more attention to the health of our plants. There can be some different reasons as to why we're seeing it. But certainly in these last few years, with the constant humidity that we've had, it's been nearly impossible to really manage tomato plants well and not get diseases on them because in most of the state of Wisconsin, I truly believe that sartorial leaf spot and early blight became airborne and essentially aerosolized so that normally when we are able to manage them on a kind of a garden-by-garden situation, these last couple of years, that just hasn't worked. So as far as getting to the direct question of what can I try to do to minimize them for next year, in a lasagna garden situation, you have a little bit of an extra step in cleanliness because you're going to probably even have to remove that upper layer of material off of your garden and replace that because it's going to be nearly impossible to separate the diseased tomato material out from the other organic material that you're using in your lasagna garden setup. In a normal garden setup, just like what we talked about earlier in the program with grape disease management, get rid of all that stuff. In fact, I just started the process of removing all my tomato vines and material within the last couple of days here. But that's a very critical step is getting that stuff out of there, rotating so that, again, a lasagna garden, you're probably not wanting to do that very much, but anyone who has space, rotate so that you don't put your tomatoes where you had any of the Solanaceae plants the year before, so the potatoes, eggplant, pepper, and tomato. And then try to get them off the ground, mulch under them, do as much as you can, and hope for a little bit different weather pattern.
Scott, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Scott Royce, UW Extension Crop Soils Horticulture Agent for Marinette and Oconto Counties. He will be definitely be back. Isn't he great? He knows so much. Our physical therapists join us on Monday to talk about lower back pain. But stay with us now. Lots more in store. I'm Larry Mueller.